Okay, good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. I'm going to call to order the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Monday, March 13th, 2017. So just to refresh everyone's memory of what we're doing here today, when we started in February, back in January, we went ahead and told folks that on February 1st, we were going to start a conversation about PERS and potentially looking at PERS reform bills, and we said to the public that we'd be welcome to submit ideas, and organizations could submit ideas as well, to make certain that all options were on the table as we look at PERS reform for the session. So with that being said, we received 16 different concepts. Some of those concepts came from individuals, and some came from organizations such as the Oregon Business Council. We have the Medford Chamber here today, others, and then others came from individual constituents. Of those 16 organizations and individuals that submitted concepts, some of them had multiple concepts in them, and there was overlap between the different ideas. In addition, those ideas, some of them overlap with Senator Knope's ideas that he has already submitted in two different bills, Senate Bill 559 and Senate Bill 560. On Wednesday of this week, we are going to go over with the technical experts Senator Knope's bills in more detail, and he has seven amendments to Senate Bill 560. So there will be, today we'll be talking about some concepts that will be the same concepts that Senator Knope also came forward with. So in our conversation today, what's going to happen is that we're going to work with Deborah here, our committee administrator, who has worked very hard to collect all this information from the public and from individuals. And we have grouped these concepts into about 10 different concepts. And she's made it into a lovely PowerPoint presentation in order to help facilitate the conversation. And we're going to ask our technical experts that are here to come forward so that we can ask questions of them. We as a committee will have DAS here, PERS, and LC here at the dais, and we can go through each of these concepts from the public. On OLIS is a document that summarizes all the proposals, and then I had it printed out for you so you can see them. So I'm going to go ahead and open or informational meeting on PERS, proposals from the public, and I'm going to ask Deborah to summarize in more detail what we're doing, and then we'll bring up the technical experts, but before we get going from the committee staff. Did you have a question, Senator Johnson?
I have two comments.
Yes.
The first one is thank you for your continuing courtesy to allow me to sit in.
Of course, I'm glad. I'm sorry, Senator Johnson's here. She seems part of the family.
And so secondly, even though this has been organized in such a fine way by your professional staff, I feel honor-bound to share a communication that I got over the weekend from a former member of this body, Ron Adams. That would make an accommodation for current retired PERS members to make voluntary contributions back. And I just felt morally bound that I share that. It may well be in here, given that I have not perused this, but he sent that to me on Sunday, and it had missed the deadline, and I now have discharged my obligation too.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Johnson. You did your duty in that you sent me the email this morning. I saw it very briefly, and I'm sorry, just because like all of us in committees all day, and I think you saw that email as well from her constituent. Maybe you did not. But we can certainly. Do you have it? I see my staff has it. We could give it to. Do you feel comfortable having that email on OLIS?
I feel fine having it on OLIS.
Okay, we could give it to Debbie, and she can put it on OLIS, and then. It's an interesting idea. Maybe I'll call on you to speak about it in more detail. So
it would be nice, Madam Chair, if those that made over $30,000 a month on their PERS retiree, that would contribute three quarters of that.
I have no problem with that, Senator Ronna Sanderson. So I'm going to, let's see, did I go ahead and open up informational meeting on PERS proposals from the public and ask Deborah to go ahead and summarize the proposals from today's meeting.
Thank you. Well, as you noted, we received 16 submissions. Some of them proposed multiple changes. Some of them had a single idea. Some were very specific, and some were really broad. So in your meeting materials is a summary of the proposals that's organized in two ways. In one of them, there is a table that is organized around the individuals and organizations who submitted the proposals, and they're identified by location or affiliation rather than their names, and it summarizes the proposals that they submitted in their entirety, which would include one or more proposed changes to PERS. The second table organizes the proposals substantively, so I broke apart the discrete proposals that were in the original submissions and regrouped them as strategies that relate to one of 10 general concepts. And that allowed us to merge the repeated or similar ideas to make that a more efficient review.
I was just noting that that's actually table one. It's by subject.
Right. I described them in opposite order.
Yeah, that's fine. Just so everyone knows. Table one is the ones that are the proposals by subject.
So the PowerPoint that you'll see today is organized substantively. The first slide will show you the 10 general concepts, and then each subsequent slide will break down those 10 concepts and show the strategies or proposals that dealt with each of those concepts. And I did just want to add that I did my best to capture these proposals as they were presented, but edited for clarity and efficiency. So if any of the summaries deviate from the submitter's intent that are watching this today or here today, I would invite them to contact me for clarification.
Yes, she did the best she could. Some of the emails were a little more specific than others. So thank you very much for doing that. Deborah has been working very, very hard on the PERS discussion, and so I just want to make certain that everyone on the committee knows how hard she's been working on this. I'm going to go ahead and call up Steve Rodman and Marissa James and Madeline Zeich, please. Steve Rodman, of course, is with PERS, and Marissa James is with Legislative Council, and Madeline Zeich is with DAS. And I'm going to ask Debbie to go ahead and turn on the PowerPoint presentation, please. And then after we go through this, I'll ask, I know Jessica Gomez, who's with the Medford Chamber, wants to speak. And then if anybody else who submitted a proposal would like to speak, maybe you could make that known with Debbie. We're not doing a whole public hearing and et cetera, but if you've submitted a proposal and wanted to give more details, then please feel free to do so. So let's go ahead and get started here, and we'll go to, so will she be running the slideshow or will you be running the slideshow?
Debbie will.
Okay, there we go. So here are the 10 general concepts. We're gonna start with the first one here. And for those in the audience, this is on OLIS. And the title on OLIS, Debbie, can you remind us on OLIS what it's called? I think it's called Proposals on the PERS from the Public. So let's go ahead and does anyone have any questions about the process? We're going to go through all these ideas that were submitted by the public and by organizations so that it's all out there. Does everyone understand? Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. The first concept, Debbie, if you want to go to the next slide, is to replace PERS with a 401k plan. And there are two strategies listed here. One is transfer all PERS to 401k accounts, and the other one is move all elected officials and judges to 401ks with mandatory contributions. So some of these ideas I know from the conversations I've had have been considered in the past, and so they may be new to this session, but they've been brought up in past legislative sessions. So I will, one of the things we always want to know is whether or not something like this is constitutional, and Marissa only has limited information, so it's hard for her, I think. I don't want to put words in her mouth. If you can kind of explain if you're even able to comment on the constitutionality when they're submitted in this general format.
Right. So Marissa James from Legislative Council, Senator Taylor, members of the committee. So I don't believe it would be a 401k, but if we're using that as shorthand for like a defined contribution plan, you could definitely do that as a new tier for brand new employees going forward. If you're trying to do that to active members, I've opined that that has a high risk of being struck down by the court. Discontinuing the pension program could be explicitly irrevocable term of the PERS contract. So we need more information to say anything about constitutionality about either of these.
Okay, thank you. Steve, can you tell us your experience? Have you ever had this asked of you before? Have you, this probably has come up, I would think, but.
Sure, there's a couple of things. Steve Rodman, Executive Director of PERS. There's a couple of things to consider with this sort of a change, and there have been numerous studies about them, and I guess it goes back to what are you trying to solve for? Are you trying to solve for the cost of PERS? Then understand that most of the employer rates we're talking about are to fund the unfunded liability, which are existing benefits already earned. So switching to a 401k going forward doesn't save you that much money over the normal cost of the OPSERP benefits that what people would otherwise go into. The other thing to realize is there's academic studies about this. A defined contribution plan is inherently less effective and efficient in providing benefits. Individuals don't have access to the broad array of investments that our Oregon Investment Council does, and at the lowest cost that the Oregon Investment Council does. So inherently, their investment return over time is not going to be as effective and efficient. There's also things that you can solve for in a defined benefit plan, like longevity risk. How much one individual needs to save is not as much as everyone in a pool would need to save to allow for the fact that some people live longer and others shorter. So if you measure it by how much it costs to provide benefits, if you measure it by that metric, a defined contribution plan is much more expensive than a defined benefit plan.
Okay, thank you. I also want to note that obviously the technical experts were given this document with the proposals in them. However, I have not had individual conversations about all of these with each of the panel members here. So I'm going to be learning right along with all of you their feedback. Okay, so do folks have any other questions about this first concept? Do you want to hear more about elected officials and judges, or?
Yeah.
Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that second bullet point there, one of the, you hear a lot from the public that it's almost an inherent conflict of interest when the judicial system is actually opining on their retirement plan. And then I think the same thing can be said with legislators who are, and for some, you know, I don't know how many, but are also legislating on their retirement plan. And so one of the things that's attractive for me on that one is to remove perceived or otherwise conflict of interest. And but you're telling me that it may not meet legal muster, and or it may not save us any money anyway. But it would remove the perceived conflict, I would think.
Chair Taylor, can I?
Sure, yes, please, Mr. Rodman.
Just to maybe put some things on the record about that perceived conflict. One is the judges are in their own plan. They are not within PERS like a Tier 1 or Tier 2 member. They have their own plan, which we administer, but it was an independent plan up till the early 90s when administration was moved over. Generally, the reform legislation that has been considered does not affect that judge plan. That judge plan is a formula plan. They contribute 7% of salary, for example, and it has its own structure. So when we talk about some aspects of the things we're talking about changing with PERS, that doesn't affect the judge member plan.
Okay,
it sits off on its own.
You want to hear from LC on that, Senator Hansel?
Sure.
I'm not sure I have much more to say about that. Most of the concepts I draft, like Steve just said, either don't apply to judges because they have a different plan, or explicitly exclude judges for that very reason, I assume. So that is one way to avoid the conflict.
Okay. Senator Montefiore.
And so if a person is elected to the legislature and then this goes away, and they are a PERS retiree, they would still get their retiree benefits as a PERS benefit, but they would then have the option to go into this other 401k type or defined benefit plan, even though they're already retired. So, I mean.
Chair Taylor, Senator Montesenison, you feel our pain. when we're asked to analyze and all we get is a line, it's really hard to extrapolate much from that.
Yeah. So it sounds like if someone had once been a public employee, retired, and or was still, I guess you could still be a public employee in some way, and serve in the legislature, then that would have to be hashed out as to how they would be removed from, I mean, it could be sorted out.
Chair Taylor, currently, anyone who joins, anyone who comes in as a legislator, and Marisa, please step in if I go wrong here, but anyone who comes in as a legislator does not join PERS for their legislative service. They have to go in, their contribution goes into the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, or they can elect not to have any contribution made on their behalf.
That's right, unless they were already a PERS member, and then they can continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if they were already a PERS member, then their legislative service does count towards their service credit for PERS.
Okay. Senator Johnson?
I think, though, what we're missing is, in feeling your pain, is the political optics of this. I think most of us hear over and over again the notion that elected officials and judges are members of PERS, ergo cannot render an impartial verdict on the PERS program, leave aside the 2003 votes and leave aside the 2013 votes. I don't, just because you're saying right now, well, the judges have a separate plan and this is complicated and we'd have to sort it out, I would hate to leave this with that cursory an explanation, because this is one of the things that I think drives public perception of the whole architecture of PERS. And I don't know, we're going through these and you're listing the problems, and I'm sure you'll be able to find a problem with just about all of them. What I'm interested in are, what are the insurmountable problems? I don't want to just say this is hard, so we're not going to talk about it. And maybe you didn't mean to convey that, but that's what I heard.
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, no, I just tried to explain how I couldn't resolve Senator Mona Sanderson's question because the details aren't spelled out. And I go back to kind of one of my first comments, which is, what do you want to solve for? If you want to solve for political optics, or if that's a driver of considering a concept, we are technical experts. We're not here to help resolve that question.
And that's fair. Conversely, I don't want you to just say, it's optics, we don't want to play. I think we're looking for you to help give us some guidance. I think if you walked out onto the street and asked 10 Oregonians, this would come up as an issue. And I maybe it's just because this is the first one of these we've looked at, and I don't know what the chair has for a process, but I don't want to leave this because it's heavy sledding.
If it's all right, I'll follow up with that. Thank you, Senator Johnson. So this is a little bit unorthodox, this whole process that we're doing, this taking the comments from the public, but we have all received emails, and I know other members have received emails about folks concerned about PERS. So the intention here is to have the dialogue in a public format, and the reason this is all organized and documented is so that we can talk about it, and then we can work together to decide if this is something that we would like to pursue. So also, you should know, because these are technical experts in these areas, and I'll go out on a limb and say, you know, they're a little uncomfortable speaking too strongly on anything without having all the details, because they don't have a bill in front of them. And so, and we know how the process works here. Usually they respond to a bill. This is a concept, and some citizens sent in concepts that were very simple, such as transfer all PERS to 401ks or something. So they have limited information they're working with, but by all means, Senator Johnson, what is happening in our, in Deborah here, will be documenting everything that, obviously we have it recorded, everything that people will be saying, and then if there's an idea here that has, you know, more interest or more support, then we can look at whether or not we want to have that if there were to be, you know, a bigger
bill. That's completely fair.
Okay.
And I
so that
I'm a bill, so they can respond directly to my...
That's right. That's right, Senator Hansel. And so Senator Knope's all business here, so let's get back to Senator Knope. Just like, yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. So one is for Marissa. So in the case, I just want to clarify as it relates to legislators. So in the case of a legislator who has retired from PERS service and then runs for the legislature, are they able to get into PERS again, or is the retirement kind of a disqualifying act and then they have to go into Oregon Growth Savings?
Senator Taylor, Senator Knope, so if you are not a member of the public employees retirement system at the time of the appointment or election, you may not become a member. I believe if you are a retired member, you can go back into the tier that you would have, that you were in before, and continue making contributions.
And then also, I do want to make it clear to all the committee members, there may be times in which our experts may or may not be able to answer something because they're working with limited information. So if they have to say, I need to check, let's let them check and then get back to us so we have the right answer. So, because some of these are going to get more detailed. But yes.
And I have a question for Steve.
Yes.
So Steve, in all the PERS reforms, fixes that you've seen over the years, have we ever dealt with what I call J-PERS? I don't even know what it's called, but I call it J-PERS, so judges' PERS.
Senator Taylor, Senator Knope, I dealt with it. I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Tried to make any reforms to the judges' PERS?
No, not that I recall.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So let's go on to the next one. This is eliminate the pension plan defined benefit. So there we'll see there are two bullet points here. One is discontinue pension program prospectively, and the other is to offer PERS and OPSERP members cash investment incentives of $8,000 to $10,000 to suspend further investment in their pension account. First, Marissa, the first bullet.
So, Chair Taylor, the first bullet is the same thing as transferring all PERS accounts to a defined contribution plan, because right now we have a defined benefit, the pension program, and a defined contribution plan. So if you discontinued the pension program, you would be left with the defined contribution portion of the plan. And again, I opined in my big opinion that I wrote that has a high risk of being struck down by the court, because I think that there's a chance that the pension program could be an explicitly irrevocable part of the PERS contract. You could certainly offer some kind of voluntary buyout, or I guess this isn't really a buyout, suspension of the pension account. You could offer some kind of, although $8,000 to $10,000 seems pretty low to me, but I don't know. That's none of my business.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so thank you for that. So Steve, can you talk about either of these?
I'm not sure to what distinction. Again, as Marisa said, the discontinuation of the pension program doesn't pay the unfunded liability, which is for benefits already earned, so you don't get relieved that burden. Whether the incentive would entice any number of people to take themselves out of the system, provided that was a legal thing to do, we don't have any way to predict how effective that might be. And so consequently, we would have to wait and see how effective that was before we would know whether and how to reduce employer rates that might come from the shifting of that population.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions?
Well, just to make sure, Senator Madam Chair. So if it's a bargain PERS contract for a pension, we have to have every person has to have a pension. They do not have the opportunity to cash out or discontinue the pension program. I need to understand that.
Chair Taylor, Senator Montes-Anderson, I think you could do a voluntary, an offer to PERS members to say, we'll buy you out. And I don't know what the details of that would be, but I think you could do that and let people choose one way or the other.
Senator Knope.
Yeah, so thank you, Madam Chair. So, Steve, we did pass a bill, I think it was in 2003, that did allow for certain people to, wasn't it doubling your account and you were done, but it was a certain time period? And
can you sure, Taylor Center in Canopa was in 01, and it allowed members who chose to get 150% of their account balance. It was to drive people to go ahead and take their withdrawal rather than go ahead and retire, because at retirement they would have been matched with 100% of employer dollars. So it would have been a 200% payment.
So we were
going to... So 150 was cheaper.
So we gave them 50% less to go out with right. cash now.
Right.
Okay. Anyone have any other questions on this one? Okay, we're going to move on. Debbie, please, to the third proposal.
Can I go back on that one more time?
Yeah, Senator Hansel.
So on that second point, Ms. Roman, no more will go into their account, but the liability for what has already been accrued would stay there on that second bullet.
That's correct.
So it's a little bit different than what you did in 201, because you had them cash everything out.
Okay. Chair Taylor said that's correct. In 2001, it was an incentive to get members to withdraw before retirement.
We're here to learn everything that, you know, it's going to be a lot of information, but okay. Senator Johnson, I know you had to step out. Did you have any other questions?
No, ma'am.
Okay. So the third concept, expand individual account programs, IEP, defined contributions. So I'll go ahead and read this one, but as we go along, they're going to get longer and more complicated. So I don't know that everyone wants to listen to me read all of these, but the first one is to allow employees to contribute more than 6% to their IEP. Second is to allow employees more investment options regarding IEP level of investment risk. And the third is to move all future OPSERP members to defined contribution model in which employee contributes 6% and employer contributes 6%, with employee option to pay up to an additional 6% to IEP, cap employer match at 12%, same as the current max, allowing employee to invest up to 18% or more into IEP. So I think we'll start, since we've been starting with LC, we'll go ahead and start with Marissa and see.
Chair Taylor, I don't see any constitutional problems with any of these. These are kind of options for employees. And then so the third one you'll see, that's different than the one that I've said is risky, because it moves all future OPSERP members to a defined contribution model. So that's creating a new tier. You're not affecting anybody's accrued benefits or benefits that they might accrue in the future. You're saying we're hiring you today and you can become a member of this new tier. That's your only choice. So that these all seem constitutionally fine.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Rudman.
So similarly, the difference between what the employer has to contribute under that third bullet and the normal cost of OPSERP is the only savings, which is about, given the normal cost of OPSERP is about 8.5, you're saving 2.5% of payroll by only contributing 6. So again, that's not significant savings. It's just you're saving 6 off of 8.5, not 6 off of 30% employer rates, because you still have to pay the unfunded liability.
Mm-hmm. But 2.5% could be, that could be significant.
On a $20 billion payroll, that's
yes,
a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. So I don't 2.5% is a good amount, maybe. So we can consider that.
So how much, Madam Chair, would that be in dealing with our unfunded liability? Did you say nothing?
Senator Taylor, Senator Montesanderson, that's correct.
Yes.
The none of these concepts reduce unfunded liability.
Because it's the IEP.
Because you can't go back.
Yeah, okay.
I believe, Mr. Rudman, and clarify, you were talking about the employer, the contribution for the
cost. But under
the
third bullet, when the concept is that you have a defined contribution model and the employer kicks in 6%, the employer is still going to have to pay the unfunded liability portion of the employer rate. So.
But it what is it now? It's 8%?
8.5% for
8.5%.
Normal cost for OPSERP.
Okay. Any other questions on this idea? Senator Knopf? Okay. Moving on to the fourth concept. This is a lengthy one. And I know this one is has quite a bit of overlap with other ideas. So let's take these one at a time. This is redirect all or portions of the IEP contributions to pension plan, possibly vary percentage of IEP contributions redirected to pension plan by percentage of funded status of system. For example, divert entire IEP contribution if funded status is below 80%, half of IEP contribution if funded status is above 80%. I'd be actually curious to hear what LC has to say about that.
Okay, so Chair Taylor, so with regard to redirecting the employee contribution to fund the pension plan, what I've said about that is that we've redirected the employee contribution in the past, and so we can probably do it again. I don't think, however, that you could redirect that contribution to pay for accrued pension benefits. But if you want to redirect it to pay for benefits accrued after the effective date, then I have said that that is probably constitutionally permissible. With regard to this specific, that you could vary the percentage, I mean, that's all, that's basically my opinion with regard to any of those types of ideas.
Okay.
I have a question. Yes, I'm sorry, I must have missed it. What is the different, what is funded status? What, define funded status.
Chair Taylor, Senator Ramona Sanderson, that's the comparison of the assets you have available to pay the benefits that you're liable to pay. So with PERS, for example, we currently sit at 79% funded. We have 79% of the assets, or 79 cents of every dollar that we need to pay for the benefits that are already earned.
Okay. So do you have anything to add for this first one here, Mr. Rodman?
No.
Okay. The next one, require employee contributions to pension plan in addition to contributions to IEP. Potentially differentiate contribution rate by their by tier level. For example, higher for tier one and two than for OPSERP or by salary. For example, no contribution on first 30,000 of salary. Allow employees to direct portion of IEP to cover contribution to pension plan. Okay, Marissa, is that that seems legal? Yeah. Is that
sure? Sure, Taylor. So it's the same answer as before.
That's fine.
I don't think that you can require employee contributions to pay for accrued benefits. So if somebody is at the end of their career,
Okay. And Mr. Rodman, do you have anything in addition to add to that idea?
The only challenge when we start getting into these triggers like salary is, Chair Taylor, we don't know how much someone makes in salary until they make it. So by that I mean, if you say you don't make any contributions on the first 30,000 of salary, some people will not hit that until November, December of a calendar year. Some people will hit it in January, February. And people who may be on track to hit it will leave employment, so they won't actually hit the 30,000. So it's just challenging to consider how you would trigger those contributions, and also consider that salary for PERS purposes is combined among all of your participating employers. So if an individual is a substitute teacher at three different school districts, we aggregate that salary. And so that person may not know about this trigger, and certainly the school district may not know about this trigger until it's actually hit.
Okay, well, thank you. A clarification. Yeah, yes, Senator Monson.
I take a look at my situation. I started out in 1980 earning $18,000 a year, and then when I retired in 2000, I was making $63,000 a year. I mean, so this is an index. You'd put 30,000 in, and it may not mean anything 10 years or 20 years from now. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think in this, again, this is all from, these are ideas we receive from the public and from entities. These are not ideas that the technical experts came up with. And so I don't know that it was it specified, do you know, Deborah, about if this was indexed, the 30,000?
It doesn't specify.
It does not specify.
Never mind.
So I think that limits our ability to comment on that. Okay, I'm going to just rely on committee members to, so that we move along, to just flag me if you have a question. The next one is to eliminate the IAP for Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, direct their employee contributions to reduce UAL and fund reserve that reduces volatility and employer rates.
A question.
Yes.
So how does, since it's the same proposal, is that intended to interact with the prior bullet? And would that mean that only the Tier 3 people are having that, the proportional, and then the Tier 1 and Tier 2 just aren't having an IAP?
So
how does the bullet we just went to interact with this bullet?
Well, so again, I broke apart the comprehensive proposals and then took similar ideas and made bullet points out of them. So they
okay.
may or may not have been
oh,
the same
okay.
proposal, and you can check by looking in Table 2
okay.
to look at the comprehensive
Thank you.
Proposals.
Sorry about that.
Yes, but eliminating the IAP for Tier 1 and Tier 2
is that constitutional?
Is, what's that?
Is it constitutional?
And so, Marissa.
Oh, the okay. So, Chair Taylor. So, now I'm not sure what this one exactly means, but it sounds like we're getting into the realm of now your employee contribution is going to go to pay for other people's pensions, which I would have to see exactly how that would work, but it doesn't sound very constitutional.
Okay.
Chair Taylor, I think that would be a violation of the federal law, which requires an individual's contributions or their contributions and pay for their benefits. In other words, whatever contribution an individual makes has to go to pay for their own benefits. Can't go into a pool or a pot or something like that that pays for other people's benefits, and they are entitled to those contributions at retirement or at withdrawal. So they take their money with them when they go.
Okay. Moving along. Now, this one has several sub-bullets here. So temporarily redirect Tier 1 and Tier 2 employee contributions into general. Oh, sorry. Are you drawing my attention?
No, hers, sorry.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Is everything okay, Debbie? Okay. Temporary redirect Tier 1 and Tier 2 employee contributions into general PERS fund to help fund base retirement benefits until funded ratio reaches 95% or above. And now we have several sub-bullets here that I'm not sure the public can see these, so I will just read them real quickly. Require PERS to establish the fund employer rate stabilization reserve with annual earnings exceeding annual earning rate and use funds prior to increasing employer contribution rates. I'll pause there and ask Marissa
oh.
to.
Well, Chair Taylor, with all of these, it's the same problem that now we're asking people to use their employee contributions to pay for already retired members, I guess, for other people's pensions.
Okay. Steve, anything?
Same comments.
Okay, so there are several sub-bullets here. Is everyone aware of those? So they can see on that slide what that's about. Okay. So now we are going to move into the fifth idea, which is, if we can go to the fifth one, Debbie, please. Thank you. And that's provide new funding sources for PERS. And I think we would all like that.
Wait, go back to number four, ma'am.
Yes, we can go back to number four, please.
So the last bullet, increasing the contribution rate by 1 to 2%, the employee, that is unconstitutional also?
Chair Taylor, Senator Monson-Anderson, I guess it depends on what you're going to do with that money. I think you could increase the contribution rate going forward to pay for the individual members' benefits accrued on or after the effective date. But if it's underneath the bullet point of that you're going to put it into the general PERS fund to help fund base retirement benefits, that's problematic.
Okay, got you. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So slide five, provide new funding sources for PERS. And this, I know we received quite a few emails on these. So this is something that I know there's quite a bit of overlap. First one is fund the unfunded liability with savings from furlough days.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Marissa, that's okay.
Chair Taylor. So all of these ideas.
I'll read them. I'll just okay. do one at a time. So, okay, furlough days. The second one is fund UAL 2% sales tax to fund PERS. fund UIL with tax revenue from the sale of marijuana, fund UAL with Oregon State Lottery funds, and then the fifth is devote income from revenue reforms to system-wide PERS side accounts for rate relief to all employers. So the first one, Marissa, the furlough days.
Chair Taylor, I'm just going to say about all of these that,
yes.
I mean, they don't have any constitutional problem when it comes to the PERS contract because they're just talking about using money for other things. I've heard Steve say several times that he wouldn't turn down money from anywhere, but these could have other problems that I don't know about because I'm not a tax expert or a lottery expert. So
yeah, and these
require more investigation.
Okay. Mr. Rodman?
I've been quoted accurately.
Okay. All right. So this is an example where, again, we received emails about these ideas, but then we need to have more information. And we could pursue them more as a committee. We could say we'd like to look at Merit. I don't know if you can. I don't know. We would have to look at them in more detail. Yes, Senator Johnson.
I would just like to opine that there is a general perception that the lottery is just sitting out there awash with money waiting to have it spent. And with the ballot measures that we passed this last time, Oregonians have just about eaten up all of the available lottery money and proscribed it for various activities. So it's not a boatload of money there anymore.
Senator Knope?
And the same applies to the revenue from sale of marijuana. All that money is prescribed, so you would be taking that from something else. So taking it from schools, taking it from police, taking it from drug prevention, and several other things, and using that for PERS. So it's not like there isn't any, unprescribed marijuana dollars that are out there, because it's all percentage-based, I believe.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay. Senator Gelsa, we were just going over the fifth concept here. There are several. The next section over, though, before we move on, where it says provide new funding sources for PERS. These were all the ideas that folks had submitted as ways to pay for the unfunded liability. And if you'd like to add a way to pay for the unfunded liability, now would be a good time to.
I do have a question.
Yes.
How many furlough days would it take to pay off the unfunded liability?
Okay. I can't even, I would have to be. Considering what the state budget is on the biennium, that would have to be a substantial amount.
In point number five, I think we need to reward the optimism of the person who put that forward, that there would be revenue reform that would be able to be used for the statewide PERS pension system. So I thought that was very interesting.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Cano. But thank you for the question, and I think that I wonder if we can have someone figure that out for us about how many furlough days it would take. It would have to be a substantial number. Yes, sir.
Well, it would depend if you were a retired kindergarten teacher or a University of Oregon coach.
Thank you, Senator Hansel.
That's why I cheer for the Beavers.
Okay, back to the subject at hand. Okay, the next one is offset employer PERS costs. Okay, There are three ideas here. Require employees to pay their half of Social Security taxes. The second is require employees to pay for their share of health care benefits. And the third is require employees to share costs for employee disability retirement plan benefits. The first one, Marissa.
Chair Taylor, once again, I mean, the first two at least don't have anything to do with PERS, so there's no problem with the PERS contract there. I don't know. Maybe this is your time to shine right here.
I mean, I'm so sorry that I keep going over you.
Oh, that's fine. I was waiting for my moment.
Introduce yourself, please.
Madeline Zeig, for the record, Chief Human Resources Officer for the state. Senator Taylor, members of the committee, in particular with the health care benefits and the disability retirement plan benefits, those are benefits that are negotiated during bargaining time. And so they're really governed within the collective bargaining agreements. Employees do pay a portion of their health care right now, and those rates are negotiated during the collective bargaining process.
In general, what is the range of the rates that they pay for their health care benefits?
It depends on the plan that they choose, but anywhere from 7% to, I think, 5% right now.
The employees pay?
Employees pay.
Okay, interesting. And then can you talk about the, and you said the cost share for the disability, which, I mean, what portion are they paying of that, generally?
That I don't know right off the top of my head, but I'll get that back to you.
Okay.
I think, Senator Taylor, if I might, that's an idea that we have disability benefits available to PERS. There is a cost associated with that. It's nominal, but it is something that we work through an evaluation, again, based on experience of how many people take a disability benefit throughout their career. So I think it's the idea, the concept is that employees would pay that share of the employer rate. I don't know what that is off the top of my head, but it's reported separately in our evaluation report.
Okay.
Question.
Yes, Mr. Senator Hansel.
Can the legislature pass legislation that will trump what can be negotiated for?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, we can't affect contracts that are already that have already been entered into. So you can affect contracts going forward, but and I don't know the length of the contracts are. You probably answer that better, but we can't. The contracts clause of the Constitution prevents us from impairing contracts that have already been entered into.
I understand that, but.
And some of them are four-year contracts and some are two-year contracts. We have 33 bargaining units that we bargain with.
And that's it. I mean, every public entity has contracts. I mean, if you're just talking about the state, we've got school districts, we've got counties, you've got cities, we've got everything.
So you said we have 33 at the state, correct?
33.
It's like, and do you happen to remember, Mr. Rodman, how many there are statewide with local public employers?
No, I don't. I don't know how many.
Not how many contracts, but how many local public employers do we have approximately?
Oh, hundreds.
In like 800 something? Or?
Yeah, but.
And then each one has their own contracts.
Right.
However, Ms. Syke, you could, the state, if it chose to, when the contract is up, the contracts can be renegotiated.
Senator Taylor, absolutely. Yeah, usually the way this works is that there's a package proposal. So as they're looking at the overall wages and benefits and other types of things within the scope of the contract, insurance is just a piece of that. Mm-hmm. But the wages and insurance is something that is always bargained during the contracts if those items are open, which they usually are.
Okay. Senator Cano? Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. So, Madeline, how easy would it be for you to provide us with the dates or the amount of years of each contract? Is that a spreadsheet that you currently have?
Senator Taylor, Senator Canope,
yes.
Did I say that
Canope,
right?
Yep.
If that wouldn't be difficult at all, and so I'll get that to you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
But if I could follow
yes,
up
Senator
on
Senator Hansel.
I'm just, I guess, I want to, regardless of when the contracts are up, do we as the legislature, do we have the legal authority, the legal ability to say that from when that contract's up that there will be no more negotiation on health benefits? It will, in fact, be funded by in its entirety by the employee. Can we set that legislatively?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, I'm reluctant to give an opinion on that particular example. I'm sure there are limits that we can place on contract bargaining. I'm not the employment attorney in our office, so I can look into what those limitations are. But I mean, there are certainly things we can do, you know, especially with regard to the pickup. You know, we've definitely had bills limiting negotiation on that or expanding negotiation on that.
And I think Senator Knopf has a question.
All right, Marissa, I'm going to take another shot at that one. So in a more general sense, could the legislature say when the collective bargaining agreements are, you know, have expired that no public entity can enter into a contract where more than the contract calls for more than 50% of salary to be dispersed in benefits. So kind of setting a limit. like a general limit?
Chair Taylor, Senator Knope, I really don't have the knowledge to answer specific questions.
We could at another time. We could bring someone, another lawyer from LC to answer that, to get to the bottom of that.
Yep.
So the paying their half of Social Security taxes, I thought that, I guess I won't say what I thought of how I thought Social Security works. Can someone please, do any of you, Ms. Syke, do you know about the Social Security payment? Does anybody? Okay, let's make a note of that for the Social Security, that we can get that question answered later, and we can put it on OLIS. Require employees to pay their half of Social Security taxes. I thought that's how Social Security worked, that you paid half and the employer paid half, but I'm not certain, so let's find out. Okay, so we're going to leave this section and go on to the sixth section, and that is reduce employee retirement benefits. So this has a lot. This is the seventh section. This has quite a few subsections. One is, and these first six concepts here are the same as Senator Knope's. So the first one is to change the calculation of the final average salary, which is what FAS means, from 3 years to 5 or 10 years. So let's just start with that one.
Okay, Chair Taylor, I've opined that that is constitutionally permissible as long as you protect accrued benefits. So I'm sure there may be multiple ways to do that, but I think the bill has that you'll use 5 years after the effective date, or you can use 3 years before the effective date if you have service in both of those time periods. So
the details would, yeah, okay.
Right, but yes, if you protect accrued benefits, I believe that that is permissible under Morrill.
So I assume the reason we would do this would be to, is the motivation here to create savings for the unfunded liability?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has several factors to it. I think the first one is that it doesn't allow, or it makes it harder to pack overtime and
okay,
and you know, those types of things into your final average salary. And I think it certainly would provide some savings. We had that looked at, didn't we? So we know the amount of savings that are there.
Mr. Rubin, do you know if there are savings and what are the
Senator
savings?
Knope, yeah, we do. These are concepts, as you said, Senator Knope has been working with us on for quite some time. So we have actuarial analyses of these that are available on our website. I think we provided those to the committee before, letters from Milliman that go through these in some detail. So I would only suggest that the savings that we've estimated depend on how this is framed. So as Senator Knope has been working on these for a while, we have language that was developed that we had analyzed. And so it kind of depends on what the outcome is. So for example, the first one says to 5 or 10. Well, we analyzed 5. So I don't know what savings 10 might be.
Okay.
And how you go, when you use the 3 and when you use the 5 are really important in trying to define what savings there might be associated with them.
Okay. Thank you. So the again, these concepts are all in Senator Knope's bills, which we're going to hear, and his amendments that we're going to hear on Wednesday. So I think we should, for the time being, pause with these and then continue on with the list. And then if we have time, we can go over them today. Otherwise, we'll be going over them on Wednesday. So let's skip down to where it says increase years of service for full retirement from 30 to 32 years.
Chair Taylor, so this one is not, do you think that one's not increasing the retirement age? That's, I'm not sure if this means increasing the retirement age or increasing the period after which you can retire no matter what your age.
Yeah.
Do you think that's what it is?
So I'm sure it's at increasing essentially the years of service before a full retirement.
Okay. Well, I've opined that that increasing the retirement age is a risky proposition because it takes a long time just by its nature to complete the years that you need to get to that full retirement. That is one of the factors that the court noted as being evidence of implied irrevocability, which could mean that that term of the PERS contract cannot be changed. So I think that one is risky.
Okay. The Mr. Roadman, do you have anything to add to that?
Only again, Chair Taylor, in how it's in who it applies to. So if it is considered as people who join the system from this date forward will be under these provisions, then I think it removes the constitutional concerns
yes.
that Marisa has. But it also means that whatever savings you might achieve from that are so far out in the future that they don't really affect your present costs very much.
Okay.
Yes, thank you for pointing
Senator
that out.
Senator Johnson.
Yes.
But is it safe to say that there would be future savings realized?
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, absolutely. There would be a reduction in the cost of those benefits as people would have to work more years to be eligible.
My point, Madam Chair, is that we keep using the lens of reducing the unfunded liability as the problem we're trying to solve for. I don't think that the legislature should lose track of system improvements going forward as having a benefit as well.
Mm-hmm. Duly noted, and I completely agree. And we are going to have a hearing in the next couple of weeks about the future of OPSERP and how well structured it is, what authority the PERS board has, and what the relationship between the PERS board and the legislature, et cetera. But I agree with you, Senator Johnson, and we will definitely remember that for future hearings. The next one here is prohibit employees from drawing on PERS benefits until age 62. Is that okay, Senator and Marisa?
Chair Taylor, I think that's the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's the same thing, too.
No, not the same thing.
Well, again, OPSERP is already 65.
Okay.
You have to be at 65 before you can draw benefits. So I think this gets getting confusing with if you're trying to relate it to Tier 1 and Tier 2 who have earlier retirement ages, those cohorts are closed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think then you're back to Marisa's analysis where you're trying to impose that on people who are already put a number of years into the system. And your challenge is going to be a higher bar in the courts with that.
Okay. Then the next one is prohibit double dipping. Now, we hear a lot, at least I feel like I've heard a lot since I've been doing this, about folks having concerns about double and in some cases triple. Some people believe it's triple dipping, which I was not aware of. This is a very, using three words, prohibit double dipping does not give much for our technical experts to work with. But can any of you, can you talk, Marisa, about what the legal restrictions are on?
Sure. Chair Taylor, so double dipping is when you're a retired member, you're drawing your pension, and then you go back to work for a public employer and get that paycheck while you're continuing to receive your retirement benefits. So we've already placed limits on that, and then there are a bunch of exceptions to the limits. We can limit it. We can remove the exceptions. It's not a contract problem.
Okay. Mr. Roadman?
Just to make sure everyone understands, when, as Marisa describes, an individual goes back to work for a public employer, under those limitations or within those exceptions, they do not accrue additional benefit. So their retirement is not enhanced by that return to work. They're just getting the paycheck as well as the retirement benefit. Similarly, if they went to work after retirement for any employer.
Senator Johnson.
I think also we should flag someplace, and I don't know why this particular one jumped up at me, but we should flag any effect that legislation might have on current workforce in terms of depleting a certain age and experience cohort from the current workforce and in some highly skilled professions, the deleterious effect that that might have on state government productivity and availability to serve Oregonians.
Question.
Senator Hanson.
Yeah, more of a statement. Coming from, 30 years as a county commissioner, I know double dipping has sometimes a bad connotation, but it actually saved local governments money to allow, retirees to come back and work without the benefits. So I'm not sure it's, prohibit double dipping. We would actually could end up costing local governments more money.
Yeah, I think this is just another example of feedback we receive from the public.
Sure.
But it's a limited, it's a three-word sentence. So then we can only, but yes, we would have to look at what the details of what that would mean. Okay, the next one is prohibit agencies from raising employee compensation in return for paying their own health care for purpose of artificially increasing final average salary.
Chair Taylor, so we did that in 2013, I believe. It's done.
Okay.
So
all right,
I can explain what it is if you want.
Isn't that nice that something's been taken care of? Okay, Steve, that's okay.
That is
not good. Okay, now the eliminate annual 2% COLA, this is definitely one we heard from several folks. So
So Chair Taylor,
yes.
We tried to do that in 2013,
yes, that's what I thought.
And it didn't work, and
okay.
We can't do it. So, mean, you can do it going forward. You can reduce the COLA, but we can't reduce the COLA with regard to retired members.
You can reduce it for Tier 1 and Tier 2?
No.
No.
Well,
yes,
retired.
Yes, you can reduce it for active and inactive Tier 1 and Tier 2 people who have not retired yet.
Right.
But not for not with regard to the benefits that they've already accrued. So,
right, Steve,
and just to again clarify, as Maurice explained, in 2013 the COLA was reduced down to 1.25% generally. So anybody who retires after that legislation gets a blended COLA, 2% for their time prior to 2013, and then that reduced COLA for their time after 2013. You could conceivably say at a date in the future that the individual gets no cost of living for any service, any benefit tied to service after that date. But again, if you look at it in the framework of savings, those savings accrue so much out into the future that it is a present, in reducing present costs, it doesn't have much effect.
Mm-hmm. But as Senator Johnson has brought up more than once, it could be a savings in the future.
Right.
Whether or not one thinks it's a good policy or not is different than there could be savings. Okay. Okay. All right. Now, suspend COLA until PERS is 90% funded.
Chair Taylor, so that we definitely can't do because that would be affecting retired members who accrued all of their right to the COLA. So.
Okay. I'm going to pass on you on that. Steve, unless there's something you wanted to add?
Just the irony when you start using these catch triggers. We get over 90% funded. You add the COLA back in, we're back under 90% funded. Because now you've added benefit.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Now, I'm really actually very proud of our fellow Oregonians and all of our organizations that care and came forward with ideas. So I'm thrilled that people are thinking about this and thinking about what to do here in Salem. So now, cap total monthly retirement benefits. That is very vague. I recognize that's especially vague one. But
well, Chair Taylor, I can talk about that a little
yes.
bit.
Okay.
So the way I see that, so if you cap your total monthly retirement benefits, you're going to basically, if you're doing that with regard to active members, you're going to say basically you're not going to accrue any more pension benefits going forward because you've already accrued the up if the cap is, you know, $1,000. You've already accrued $1,000 in benefits, so you're not accruing any more pension benefits going forward. To me, that's the same as freezing the pension, which I've opined is highly risky. So
okay.
That's what I'm upset about that one.
Steve, anything you wanted to add?
No.
And then I'm so sorry I keep passing over you, Ms. Secretary.
That's fine.
Did you want
I'll,
any of these so far?
I'll speak up if there's
you
something
please
that
do,
I feel like
because
I want to
some
add.
Of these I know cause not that this one necessarily automatically triggers or doesn't trigger if there's something in the CBA, but because you know the CBAs, the collective bargaining agreements, in far more detail than we do, I should have said this at the beginning, and I apologize. Please just motion to me and speak up, okay?
I most certainly will.
Okay. So the next is direct PERS actuary to use risk-free rate of return in calculating Tier 1 money match benefit.
Chair Taylor, I think Senator Knope has that bill, and I opine that it is constitutionally permissible.
Okay. Can you talk about...
So what is risk-free? Savings account at 0.1% in a credit union or bank? What is risk-free?
Well, Chair Taylor, there's been a variety of different rates that people have suggested, and I don't know much about what the different rates are, but maybe Steve knows more about that than I do.
Chair Taylor, Senator Ramona Sanderson, an excellent question again. Even with Senator Knope's concept, which was reducing the, reduced money match annuitization rate. When people use terms like risk-free rate of return or the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation or PBGC rate, that's not very precise. So, and markets change rates all the time. So in analyzing the concept for Senator Knope, we just picked 3.5 because we said, well, if it landed at 3.5, here's what the effect would be. So short of this legislation telling us which rate to use, it's going to be hard to kind of figure out what effect that's going to have. So that's again, a struggle we have with that bullet, the one after that, which says on market conditions, what market for who doing what. So.
I do want to, can I point out one more thing about that one? In my opinion, I talk about how that does create an unusual situation where you're using one rate, a lower rate, to calculate the money match, but you're using a higher rate to assume the growth of other money in the system that is invested the same. So there could be an argument there that that is an untenable situation, that you're using two different rates to predict the growth of the same money.
Senator Knope?
Just some feedback on that. So I think when you do an annuity, it's quite a bit different than all the investments that PERS has. So there may be some difference there, but obviously needs to be explored.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then the next is set annuity rate for money match on real market condition instead of an assumed interest rate.
Chair Taylor, that's the same idea.
Same comment.
Okay. Then eliminate tax remedy benefit for out-of-state PERS retirees.
Chair Taylor, we did that in 2013.
Then the last one in this section is align prospective benefits for Tier 1 and Tier 2 members with OPSERP members, except for earlier retirement ages for Tier 1 and Tier 2.
Chair Taylor, so the word prospective there is key. We can change the benefits going forward with, you know, the caveats that the certain things could be irrevocable benefits.
Mm-hmm. Anything you wanted to add, Mr. Rudman?
Only that again, where that line gets drawn is difficult to define, in the sense that there are the disability provisions, the purchase provisions, all of the things that have been built into Tier 1 and Tier 2 over the years. I don't know if those all go away under this idea, and that these individuals basically just go into OPSERP, because all of those contribute to the different costs of the plan.
Okay, so maybe some additional exploring. So we would need to do additional exploring, because it could play out differently depending on how you framed it.
Right.
Okay, so we'll note that. Okay, before we leave this section, we have three more sections to go over, and we have some folks who want to come forward. Okay. The next section is limit growth. This is the eighth section, limit growth of unfunded actuarial liability. And the two bullets here are offer PERS members voluntary buyout of pension benefits. That was briefly mentioned earlier, but we'll go over that again. Offer PERS members paid insurance until age 65 upon early retirement. So the first one, Marissa?
Chair Taylor, if a voluntary, you know, take it or leave it, I think that's fine.
Okay. Mr. Rodman, I recognize that there are different things, like that the age and how much benefits they've accrued, this type of thing.
I would also just raise, though, that this is something that's talked about in the private pension world, and again, so much at the federal level is in flux with the new administration, but prior direction from the federal government had prohibited this practice, certainly for retired members and for. And then the challenge you run into with active members is you cannot make a distribution to them while they're active. So they would have to leave employment in order to take this buyout, if it was even permissible.
But a person could, if they worked for the state from age 25 to age 35, said, I want to leave and I want to be bought out, and then they go and take a different job in the private sector.
And Chair Taylor, we have withdrawal provisions already for that.
Okay, that is currently legal.
Yeah.
So explain to us the voluntary the system as it works now, if a person comes forward and says, I want to voluntarily leave PERS, or how does that work?
So a Tier 1 or 2 member that withdraws from PERS prior to retirement is given their account balance, and that is the extent of their payment to them, plus their IAP if they have one. An officer member can withdraw if they are vested, which means they've worked for 5 years generally. They get, of course, their IAP as well, and then they get the present value of their withdrawal, the present value of their pension benefit as a withdrawal amount, provided that that present value is less than $5,000. If that's just a threshold that's been put in the statute. If their benefit is worth more than $5,000, they cannot withdraw, but instead have to wait and draw retirement when they're eligible to draw retirement.
So it is restricted by their age. They have to be at the retirement age?
No. Withdrawals are prior to retirement age.
Withdrawals
are prior to retirement
age. With total withdrawal?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Then the other half of that was the offer PERS members paid insurance until age 65 upon early retirement.
Chair Taylor, I don't see why you couldn't do that.
Don't we already have that? Offer paid insurance until age 65 if they were to leave early? I mean, what's the, if they retire at 62, I guess then they have to pay for their own insurance.
Right.
Yeah, so that would be.
It's, okay. I believe the 65 is probably chosen to get them to Medicare age.
Yeah, okay. Any questions on that?
And that can affect, how would that affect PERS?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, that's hard to say, but I can't see how it would do it well or affect it well. You're trading, your early retirement is actuarially reduced. So that means, let's say that somebody who's officer if it in can retire at age 65, let's say they choose to go out at 62. They can do that, but then their benefit is reduced. And we're adding on now 3 years of health insurance, which is probably more expensive than what they were already getting as a benefit, cost to that.
Okay, then the next. Yes,
Senator Madison. I thought some public entities had their employees pay for their health insurance until they retire at 62 and then they need to pay for their health insurance until they're 65 where Medicare kicked in for them.
And Chair Taylor, Senator Mona Sanderson, I think the concept is the employer would pay for that under this, not the employee certainly already has.
Right. Gotcha.
Okay, then the ninth one is to change PERS investment management practices. And we've gotten some emails on this. I know that this has also been discussed in the media. Reduce investment management costs by managing investments internally.
Taylor, I think Steve's
going to
have the floor on that one.
Yeah, Chair Taylor, I think the details on that are something better directed at the investment division.
Mm-hmm.
I know this was behind their Investment Modernization Act that they have been talking about through the last several sessions.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know that a lot of their internal staffing was enhanced through 2015 budget cycle, and they're back with more of an ask for this budget cycle. And so I'm not quite sure how much savings is left on the table because a lot of that management is being brought back in-house.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think if you wanted to get more in detail, you'd have to bring in the investment folks.
So there may be some there, but not necessarily, but it's also an enormous responsibility.
And I guess to maybe channel Senator Johnson, saving money is always a good idea. So just because it may not save money on PERS, it would certainly be a good idea to reduce our investment costs.
Of course, there's a lot of risks by managing. These are enormous sums of money that we're talking about here. So, okay, and then the last one here is calculate contribution rates by category of employee. Establish separate, quote-unquote, pots for funding different categories of PERS members, such as athletic directors, teachers, doctors, and nurses, first responders, public work employees, et cetera.
Chair Taylor, I'm going to let Steve talk about that one, too.
Okay.
We only have two different categories of PERS. We have general service and police and fire, and that's because they have two different benefit structures. So they have two different costs. We don't slice and dice the types of occupations. You're either in general service or you're in police and fire.
What about judges?
Completely different plan. Sorry, Chair Taylor.
Is that not considered a third?
Sure, I just forgot about him.
That's okay. I just was clarifying that we had discussed judges. I just want to make sure I wasn't missing something. Yes, Senator Johnson.
A subset of this that I keep bringing up is the question of what counts as salary. And I look at the athletic departments that are supported by either the foundations or athletic foundations at the universities. And you have batted me away each time that I raise the question of research dollars and how they're treated and whether those become part of final salary. And I still either am too dumb or unwilling to accept your answer.
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, I don't know that I've batted you away. It's just that I don't know the answer because it depends on that individual's relationship with the university and whether the university has agreed to take that money and then pay part or all of it out as a salary, or whether that money gets paid directly to the individual. If it's paid directly to the individual, I never see it, it never counts.
I follow.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Given, this is perhaps to Ms. James, and she may not be an issue expert, but given that we have ceded so much control of the universities to the universities themselves, is there any chance to use any legislatively mandated modernization as far as sources of income with respect to the university so that we could end this practice of these enormous athletic salaries, which I think have helped drive public perception of the PERS system?
Chair Taylor, Senator Johnson, I know nothing about the salary structure of universities, but that sounds like something that could be done legislatively.
I think we should make note of that, Senator Johnson.
And I know the world's biggest duck fan is at the end of the dais, so I am treading on very thin ice, and I acknowledge that for the record.
Senator Hanson.
Well, I'm just wondering, too, I think the other very large salaries are like at OHSU or some of our research medical profession, too, and I think I'm wondering if the same type of scrutiny can be made on that level or any just generally above a certain salary, regardless of where they are in the system, to have a special.
I'd be remiss not to note, of course, too, that we've had salary limits in place since 1996. So why we hear about people that we hear about with these large salaries is because they have been in the system since or prior to 1996. But anyone in the last, whatever that is, 21 years, the new coach, whoever that new coach may be that the university hires today, is subject to the salary limitation, which this year is $270,000.
Thank you. That perhaps addresses my issue.
That helps.
Yeah. Senator Cano?
That was my clarification.
Yes. So I want to go back to the, let's see, just make certain that I'm clear. Section 7, I said that there were six ideas. We started to talk about the first one that are going to be discussed with, that are actually Senator Canope's, happen to also be ideas that Senator Canope has in either of his bills or in his seven amendments. And those are the change calculation of final average salary from 3 to 5 or 10 years, cap annual salary of $100,000 for calculation of final average salary, exclude lump sums for sick leave, vacation leave, or overtime from calculation of final average salary, reduce multiplier for calculation of pension benefit under full formula, raise retirement age, and then reduce money match annuitization from 7.5% to 3.5%. So on Wednesday, we're going to go over these in more detail, and we'll have the technical experts here. We have Ms. Gomez here from the chamber, and then Mr. Nisbet, did you want to speak today? And so I think that we should, because they came all this way, that we want to have them. I'm sorry that I don't think we'll have quite enough time. If we do, we can. If you guys could stay, please, then we could go over these if we have time. But I'm going to go ahead and bring Jessica Gomez up, since she came a little bit farther, I think, than you did, Mr. Nisbet. Came all the way from Medford, but you came yesterday?
Yes, I did.
Okay, well, thank you for coming all this way.
Yes,
this is an individual who cares about PERS and cares about Oregon, and I really appreciated your detailed report that you sent, so thank you.
So thank you so much. I prepared something in writing. I know I have a short time, so I'll go ahead and read that now to you. First, I'd like to
state your name and who you're with,
et cetera, please. This is my name is Jessica Gomez. First, I'm the CEO of Rogue Valley Micro Devices. I'm also serve on the chamber board for Jackson County Medford Chamber. So thank you, Chair Taylor, and the rest of the committee for hearing me today. You know, I really appreciate your efforts to try to resolve this unfunded liability issue. I'd also like to thank Pam Marsh for, you know, making it possible for me to come before you today. So many have tried to place blame on each other for the current situation. This is not helpful and only diminishes our ability to work together. What is important is that we have the courage and ingenuity to resolve this financial burden before it consumes the important resources we all rely on. I am here today to present a concept that achieves this goal. Public employees have been promised a secure retirement, which is one of the reasons why many choose to work in the public sector. They have, in effect, signed a contract with the state. The state cannot break this contract. The state, however, may be able to renegotiate the terms of that agreement in a way that's mutually beneficial to both parties. After careful consideration of several concepts, I, along with a group of distinguished business leaders from Southern Oregon, have developed the PERS realignment strategy for Oregon. Today, I will focus on the cornerstone of that strategy, the accelerated disbursement option. For a period of time, so here's how it works. So for a period of time, those receiving or about to receive retirement benefits will be given the option to receive a one-time cash disbursement in place of their monthly benefits. The collective disbursements will be funded by a bond measure that will be amortized over a period of 30 years. This will allow more cash to remain in PERS and, in effect, amortize a portion of the PERS debt over 30 years at a lower interest rate than the interest rate earned by PERS investments. If the beneficiary chooses, they can roll over the same some or all of their disbursement into their 401k plan or investment of their choice, thereby reducing or eliminating their tax liability. The advantage of this program to the beneficiary is immediate access to the retirement benefit and flexibility to invest those benefits in a way that is best for them. The advantage to the state is that it will be able to meet its obligations to PERS beneficiaries, increase funding levels in PERS investments, and amortize a portion of the unfunded liability over an extended period of time. So thank you very much for this opportunity to come before you.
Sure. Did you have any other concepts you wanted to discuss? I mean, I know we went over. So just so folks know, in Table 2, the fourth concept down, or excuse me, the fifth concept down is from the Medford Chamber of Commerce. And so was there, I know some of yours overlap or the same as
yes.
Senator Canope's. And so was there anything else you wanted to add? Or?
I think that's it. I think, you know, from what I've seen, you're really looking at all of those concepts in a lot of detail. We also kind of compared a lot of different documents that had similar concepts, tried to combine them as you, Deborah, have done also, and looked at, you know, what look like the most viable concepts for remaining constitutional, and also looking at sort of reforming the system as we move forward so that we don't end up in this situation again. The reason why I wanted to come and testify on the accelerated disbursement option is that kind of deals with the current sort of unfunded, that big 63%. Portion that's tier one that's really carrying the bulk of that debt for us right now. So I think, you know, for the time being, that's maybe the most impactful, although, you know, there needs to be sort of some detailed financial analysis and modeling done on that concept to really, you know, determine whether or not it's going to be a viable savings.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Is Ms. Gomez written testimony on OLIS or part of the record?
Yes, so she has a whole report here.
Oh, thank you.
The PERS realignment strategy for Oregon.
Yes.
It is a product of the Medford Jackson County Chamber. So it is there. And yes, Senator.
Where did you say that was summarized?
So in table two.
Table two, okay.
And the fifth concept down, yeah, okay. This is summarized, but on OLIS, it looks like this, if this helps.
Yeah, I've got that.
It looks like this in her idea. So thank you very much, and we're going to call for Mr. Nisbet.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, with apologies, I have to excuse myself. Mr. Nisbet, I apologize. I'll get caught up with you at some point or watch this, the record on TV.
Welcome.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nisbet. I've been serving for the past several months as an advisor to the Oregon Business Council on the issue of PERS. We submitted a document which runs to 8 pages in your packet. And I wanted to put that in the context of what we've seen in your presentation and how you've organized the proposals to date, which we appreciate. Mm-hmm. Mr. Rodman asked an important question: what do you want to solve for? Mm-hmm. And our answer to that is we want to solve the, or mitigate at least, the claim on budgets that is coming into force from these increased PERS cost contribution rates, which will severely limit at every level of government in Oregon service delivery and what we can do to manage these costs in terms of impact on services to taxpayers. The solving to that problem of the increase in cost, it might be good to look at it in context. Over the last 40 some years, the average rate of employer contribution to PERS has been 12% of payroll. It varied from a low of just over 9% to a high currently of 17.5%. So we're at the high point over that 42-year period. And it's projected now to go to 32.4% of payroll over the next 6 to 7 years by 2023. If the rates were not projected to be going up, I wouldn't be here. It's because we're now at this point, 17.5% of payroll, which you're managing to, but we're going to 32. And I don't know how we can continue to manage to absorb cost impacts like that on our budgets at the state level, local level, school districts without severe consequences. So I would urge that we look to solving the problem based on that increase and try to minimize or mitigate as much of that increase as possible. I'd also suggest that the way to do that is to back off of these distinctions between unfunded liability and normal cost and actually look at that ongoing cost right now and the fact that only about 30% of the unfunded liability is due to the current workforce. On the other hand, you can say as much as 30% of the unfunded liability is an underfunding for the benefits for those currently working. And that, I think, creates a very useful benchmark to keep in mind as we try to solve this budget problem. The other is, so in other words, I would say that if we were asking employees to contribute to a solution that amounts to more than 30% of the unfunded liability, we're asking for too much. But still, that 30% is significant. And it's in the ballpark of some of the proposals submitted here. It's certainly in the ballpark of what we presented as well. What we present, I think, are summarized in your categories 4 and 7. They have to do with prospective benefit reductions, and they have to do with...
I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second. So Mr. Nisbet's with the Oregon Business Council, and in table two, just so everyone can see where you're... So it's the 9th concept down. It's on page 6 of the document. And they have three concepts in total, but there's a lot of detail in them, and of course I've read your report more than once, and I think that others have, and a lot of the ideas, as you heard, were discussed previously, and a lot of them are also in Senator Knope's bills and amendments, but go ahead and keep going.
Thank you. I don't think, however, that we've paid enough attention to other equity issues. I just mentioned the equity issue of what's the size of the unfunded liability or the underfunding due to the benefits promised to current workers, and that's an important benchmark, but I'm not sure that's the best one to use. I think we should look at how do we offset as much of those payroll rate increases that would otherwise affect budgets going forward. And there are two other points which deserve attention that also involve equity. One is that we basically have about half the workforce, a little over half, now in OPSERP, and half in Tier 1 and Tier 3. The cost to employers for the officer group is 8.5% payroll. The cost to employers for the Tier 1 and Tier 2 group is 15.1% of payroll. And that has nothing to do with the unfunded liability. That's the normal cost, the cost for the benefits that are being earned from month to month. So I think it would be worth, when we look at all these proposals, to start with the Tier 1 and Tier 2 group, those employed before 2003, and see as much as possible we can get to a point of equalizing benefits going forward between Tier 1 and Tier 2 and OPSERV. Now, that's prospective. That's going forward.
Sure. So, yes, we have been looking at all of that, of course. Yeah. And a lot of people know that the costs lie more with the Tier 1 and Tier 2 than the OPSERV. And I think right. that's been noted, not just here in the committee, but we knew that from what was passed in 2013, et cetera. So my question for you, and I know that you've worked very hard on this subject and you've looked at it extensively, is so one, we do have to pay the nearly $22 billion unfunded liability. That is a real cost that's there. And yes, the employer contribution, the percentage of payroll is significant. That's pretty undeniable for local employers and for the state. And so how do you propose that we pay for those two things?
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah.
That was my next point. So we would recommend that we start with the Tier 1, Tier 2 group and look at modifications in benefits that can be made to reduce their ongoing cost closer to that 8.5.
Does that mean reducing benefits going forward?
Mean reductions in benefits.
Okay, and what specifically, which benefits specifically?
Well, there's a whole list of them, page 5.
Yeah, no, I know. I just want to make sure, do we have it all on record here? We have the document here. But so you are recommending that we reduce benefits. Can you go into more detail about which ones you think that we should reduce for the Tier 1 and Tier 2? Is that
well, Senator, it might be more helpful to start with the idea of what if we could say that all of the Tier 1, Tier 2 employees prospectively would move into OPSERP at the OPSERP cost. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if somebody works 22 years under Tier 1 and 8 years under OPSERP, you could prorate the benefits just as you're doing now with the COLAs. That's easier said than done for a lot of reasons. The main reason is, as Mr. Rodman has reminded us, we have different retirement ages in the two plans. So you can't really prorate between two different retirement ages. And that's a major point, cost driver in Tier 1 and Tier 2 with those early retirement ages. So we should look at all the other features, the percentage of salary, the salary base, whether it's 3 years or 5 years or more, those other dials on the dashboard, so to speak, that could be adjusted to get to what would probably then be an OPSERP plus program. It would be richer than OPSERP, but cheaper than the one we have now, and by the way, still adequate. And I say that from personal experience. I worked 5.5 years for Governor Kitzhaber and Governor Kulongoski. Mm-hmm. I worked 27 years in the union movement. Mm-hmm. My 5.5 years in OPSERP were better in retirement benefits than my 27 years in the union movement, than any five-year period in my 27 years with the union movement. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an adequate benefit. In addition, what we should be looking at is what can be more affordable going forward and tend to equalize benefits and affordability throughout the workforce. And then finally, also on a point of equity, if there is to be a redirect or an employee contribution which could be covered by what's now in the IAP, which is the concept we've submitted, we think it also makes sense to recognize that lower paid employees have less ability to pay than higher paid employees, and lower paid employees depend more on that pension benefit as a percent of salary than higher paid employees.
So going back to your earlier comment, are you in support of what we call the 6% redirect?
We think a better way to do it would be to say, at least for Tier 1 and Tier 2, maybe for OPSERP, is to establish a contribution rate going forward and let employees direct some of what's now their IAP contributions to cover their pension contribution if they choose. And by the way, if we were starting the contribution at something like $30,000 of salary, as Mr. Rodman described, and that was in our proposal, that was just an example, you would set it at a monthly. You know, you wouldn't wait till the end of the year. You'd say $2,500 a month. Above that, there's a pension contribution. So these are concepts which we think help to make sense for hanging all these different options on the same framework and looking at how much can be saved going forward with the goal of having a more affordable but still adequate retirement plan for all employees in the future, but also one that means less employer costs going forward. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the percentages involved and you add up everything of what's potentially feasible, and I'm not saying we can get there with all these pieces, but certainly with the ones that are legally viable. You're approaching that 4.5% of payroll that would have been saved under the 2003 grand bargain package that was largely overturned by the courts. And you're also getting close to that 30% of the unfunded liability, which is attributable to the current workforce. Not that that's explicitly the goal here, but that's one of those benchmarks we want to make sure we're not exceeding. So we would hope that taking that approach, mm-hmm. starting with the benefits going forward for those in Tier 1 and Tier 2, starting with employee support, cost sharing, starting with the higher paid employees as well as those employed before 2003.
And do you feel that those concepts have not been considered to date for Tier 1 and Tier 2 employees that you're suggesting now?
I think most of the benefit adjustment or benefit reduction options have been. Mm-hmm. The ideas that I don't think anybody else has brought to you are the ideas that there be a contribution, if not a redirect of the IAP, or a contribution which could be supported by a redirect of the IAP, an employee option, and that those contributions start with Tier 1 and Tier 2 to get them closer in line with the OPSERP benefit, and that they also recognize salary and ability to pay. I think those are the new ideas we brought to you in terms of employee cost sharing going forward.
And so the unfunded liability, the mere $22 billion approximately, outline, how would you suggest that that gets paid for?
Well, if you were to implement the changes prospectively in benefit reductions going forward and in employee cost sharing going forward in the ways we describe, there'd probably be a savings of $4, $5, or $6 billion, something in that range. Again, similar to what was incorporated in the 2013 package.
So
that would leave $16 billion.
So I just want to be clear. So you're suggesting that one way that we could pay for part of, not all, of the unfunded liability is to reduce benefits from Tier 1 and Tier 2 employees. Correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but reduce benefits from Tier 1 and Tier 2 employees and take that quote-unquote savings from that and use that money to pay down the unfunded liability?
Not explicitly,
okay.
Senator,
okay.
But I said we're trying to find ways to manage and mitigate, manage these costs mm-hmm. and mitigate their impacts on budgets.
Oh, yeah. No, so I'm just trying
and
to make
so
sure.
And so, in effect, by asking the question, what's a adequate and affordable retirement plan going forward and getting there mm-hmm. for all employees, you will be reducing employer costs by some amount. That's not saying you're transferring those dollars to the person.
Okay, so you're saying make a savings, have a savings occur.
Create an offsetting savings to budgets by asking yourself, based on what we've seen with Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP, what's the level of benefits we want to provide going forward that's fair to employees? And I think you do have to distinguish between the pre-2003 and the post-2003 employees going forward, because there's very little of the unfunded liability attributable to those hired.
And then
since
how would we pay the remaining $16 billion?
That's the whole new category which Ms. Gomez and others are tackling in the kinds of proposals they brought forward. That then becomes a cost which, if we do a thought experiment here, mm-hmm. the question is...
I'm open to ideas.
The question is, should that really be a payroll cost? Going forward, it's for those already retired. Mm-hmm. Should it be looked at as something that we take off of payroll, mm-hmm. and look at how we pay for it over time through, let's say, another form of bonding? As different variations are possible here, but I think we should honestly ask whether
bonding financing.
Yes, bonding for the increment.
Mm-hmm.
In other
we
words, you're looking at mm-hmm. incremental cost increases over the next biennia of about $800 million a biennium. With the adjustments we described, you're probably reducing that to maybe $600 million a biennium. Mm-hmm. If you just focused on your general fund agencies and the general fund support you provide for schools and cities and counties, mm-hmm. you're probably down to closer to $400 million a biennium. And I think now you're in a range in which there are always going to be opportunity costs here. That's the thing. There's opportunity costs. You're going to confront them no matter what. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a much more manageable amount, and I think it would be worth looking at how we can take the remaining obligation off payroll and look at ways in which the state can take responsibility
for the
unfunded
$16
liability that continues
so
to exist for those who are retired.
I just want to make sure I understand. So are you suggesting that the state take the responsibility of the $16 billion in this scenario? We have the savings occur with the $5 billion regarding benefits, and then the $16 billion would be the the state take that on so that local public employers don't bear that burden.
Well, I might be I might be flying too close to the sun here, but
I want to have the dialogue in the public. We really want to have the dialogue in the public format. So I just
what we're saying is, look at that. Ask the question about whether that should continue. That liability should continue to be apportioned as a percentage of payroll. Mm-hmm. To all of your agencies and to school districts.
I think we recognize it's a definite.
And then ask, or how much, maybe not all, how much of that can be handled with some bargaining, some bonding, to mitigate the impact on budgets and the squeeze on services that whether it's going to.
I think Senator Gelser has a question.
Yeah, I think I have a disconnect with that, with the recommendation around the bonding, because the presentation that we had around, you know, kind of borrowing against the debt and pushing, we would spend more in the long term and really not save anything. So do you have a different proposal that the Office of the Treasurer didn't have the opportunity to consider that would actually give us relief and not cost us more money in the long term?
Thank you, Senator. I'm saying that once we take actions to address the future costs and the ongoing costs on payroll, as I described, and we look at the effect on the unfunded liability from that, and then we look at whatever the effects are that might stretch out the unfunded liability from borrowing over a longer term. At the bottom line, we should be reducing that unfunded liability year by year. If we're not, that's in the category of kicking the can down the road and making the problem worse. But I think with the two combined, we can achieve that. Top line would be savings from benefit reductions and cost sharing going forward. Mm-hmm. The next line would be mitigation of the overall costs through borrowing and extending the amortization period. Next line after that should show a reduction on funded liability, or else you're borrowing too much.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you. So my understanding of the presentation on the borrowing was that we were looking at the existing unfunded liability, which we can reduce benefits going into the future however much we want, but we can't really chip away at what is already owed. So any savings that we would find moving forward would be new additions to that unfunded liability. The unfunded liability that exists, we heard that not only can we not save money doing that, we will incur additional cost.
Senator, the savings going forward by paying a lesser rate of payroll for the benefits being earned starting tomorrow or next week or next year would be true savings, which would offset the effect on budgets.
That's making the assumption, however, that that savings that the local public employer would make, to keep the math simple, if it went from 15% to 10%, then the local public employer would not be contributing that 5% to the unfunded liability. So we would still be responsible for the unfunded liability. The idea is to reduce the burden for the local public employer. So then we would say you're going to offer less benefits, fewer benefits to your public employees, but then we would not turn around and say then you need to give that savings to pay down the state's unfunded liability. So someone would still need to pay the unfunded liability.
That's right.
We cannot borrow, obviously, $16 billion. We cannot bond against that. That is far too large of
right.
a
But Senator, what I was calling out is that, remember, we're at the all-time high of 17.5%. If we could keep it there, I think we'd all declare victory. But there are these increases coming on at 2-4% of payroll over the next several biennia. And that's what we should look at. And if we can look at the incremental costs coming on to budgets, payroll and budgets, mm-hmm. and bond for those increments over time and still end up at the bottom.
Oh, you just
line.
Want to bond for the incremental
yeah, increase. So in other words, you're minimizing the opportunity costs and the squeezing out of other good purposes for your bonding capacity.
So thank you for bringing that forward. I think that I'm not sure if you were here the day that we had the Oregon Investment Council here and the person who oversees the bond from the Treasury Office, and it was a very sobering conversation about the cost of bonding. And Senator Gelser, I believe, is correct to mention the long-term cost of that. And you are bringing up an interesting point, though, Mr. Nesbitt, that we do have, and we hear from local employers all the time, from school boards to Association of Cities and Counties, et cetera, that they are burdened with paying, the burden on the payroll is significant. And I think that we hear that, right? That it's costing percentage of the payroll is quite a bit. And, you know, we, of course, would like to help local public employers to address that. We continue, though, we have this responsibility for the $22 billion. That is there. And any kind of savings that would occur at the state level or at a local public employer level, then the idea that those savings would then be, I'm going to use the word redirect, which is used in many different ways when we talk about PERS, that that money would then go to pay down the unfunded liability, can maybe work in some ways at the state level, but at the local public employer level, that's not really providing a payroll burden. That's not really providing a relief for them, because then they would still be, we would still be asking them to be paying down the debt, and they're still responsible. Local public employers are still responsible for their portion of the $22 billion at this point. Whether or not the state chooses to come in and help with that burden is a different conversation.
And Senator, what you're describing is translated to employer rates mm-hmm. of payroll. And again, you know, we're at 17.5, we're going to 20.8 mm-hmm. in July. And some school districts are higher, some are lower, some have higher and lower rates because of mm-hmm. pension obligation bonds. But it's that measure, how much is required of the employer as a percent of payroll for the current workforce, that is going to change by virtue of the changes in categories 4 and 7 in your slide presentation.
Yes, that is the we are looking at for the next couple of biennium, the burden on local employers going up, and we've had presentations on that. And it is very concerning, and I appreciate you coming and talking and paying attention to this very important issue. I think that we still are grappling with what to do, but I think that everything that you've brought forward is being considered. Do you feel that there's something that you've brought forward that is not being considered either by the committee or by past legislative?
Senator, no. I was just recommending that you look at it in this framework of mm-hmm. adjusting benefits, starting with the Tier 1, Tier 2 group. Looking at any employee contribution based on those categories as well as ability to pay by virtue of salary.
Fair enough. I think that's a valid point.
And, Senator, if I can have one more caveat.
Yes, sir.
I was in answering your question, I was kind of describing a thought experiment here about how to handle the remaining okay. unfunding liability.
Okay.
I'm not representing a point of view for any client of mine on that.
Oh,
one.
No.
That was me mm-hmm. flying high, maybe too close to the sun. But.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm just also paying attention to time here because we're past the committee time. Okay. But I really want to thank you for coming and for sitting through the whole presentation and listening to all the viewpoints. And I am going to go ahead and close the informational hearing. Our next meeting is on Wednesday, March 15th. We'll have a public hearing on Senator Knope's two PERS bills with the technical panel. We'll go into more detail about the ideas, which will also overlap with his 7 amendments, and we'll also have a public hearing on Senate Bill 913. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Thank you, and adjourn the meeting on Senate Workforce Committee. Thank you. Workforce Committee. Thank you.